Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 15th episode of the Forensic Anthropology Companion Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Kennyhurst. Today, I am joined by the following authors from the paper, Terminology Used to Describe Human Variation in Forensic Anthropology.
I am Marin Palud. I'm an associate professor at the University of Nevada, Reno in the anthropology department, and I am a bioarchaeologist and a forensic anthropologist.
I'm Casey Philbin. I'm a research professor in the chemistry department at the University of Nevada, Reno. I'm a chemical ecologist and data scientist.
My name is Shaughnessy Clemens, and I'm a biocultural anthropologist. I'm currently a PhD student at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro in the Department of Biology.
My name is Samora Horsley. I'm a first-year master's student at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and my focus is on forensic anthropology.
Also co-authored by Cassie Skipper, Alba Craig, Krista Latham, Katie Zedlick, and Deborah Baim from Volume 4, Number 4.
Could you please briefly describe the article and give three main takeaways?
So the article goes into terminology usage over the past 40 plus years, specifically focusing on forensic anthropology articles within the Journal of Forensic Sciences as the journal that represents the main professional body, the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. So we wanted to explore how terminology was used and how it was employed and how that has changed over time. So we looked at 300 plus articles and really saw that there were a couple of trends. And one of the main takeaways for me from this article is that terminology that we use is very imprecise, and we are not good at defining what these terms mean, and we're not good at using them consistently and in ways that are meaningful to biology or ways that are meaningful to our society or to the research that we're doing. Another key takeaway is that, in essence, we're taking these terms that we use within forensic anthropology research to study human variation, and we are ultimately linking those to social race categories. So it's hard for us to kind of step back and say that we're not linking skeletal phenotype to social race categories, because our research is doing that through the terms that we use and the way that we're employing them. Kind of the main takeaway is that we need to really critically evaluate the research that we're doing, how it can harm communities, and really what are we doing? And part of doing that, part of really reflecting and critically evaluating, is to define our terms. Because once we start to try to define them, it gets harder and harder to justify some of the work that we might be doing.
I do a lot of work with evolutionary ecologists, and you don't see this kind of stuff. So this was just really interesting for me to get a different perspective and kind of apply some of the tools of how we look at ecological systems and use it to kind of evaluate social.
One of the major takeaways I'd like everyone to consider is that language, just like people, are forever adapting and changing. And even the thoughts and ideas that we present here in this paper, we might feel differently about them 10 years from now. Not so much different in that we want progress to continue, but different in, you know, the definitions or the phrasing and things like that we provide. Oftentimes, I think we get bogged down by the idea and the fact that, you know, a definition should be static and this is what this word means. And so that's what it means. But definitions change, and the connotation of a word also can change throughout time. And so I'd like that to be a major takeaway from this paper as well, is that it's forever changing.
So a lot of what I was going to add has been touched upon, but I think it's really important to realize the impact of the terms and languages that we're using, and understanding that one of the ways it impacts us as forensic anthropologists is like in our ability to identify unidentified and missing persons. And also just like understanding like the discrepancy between the language use we have and like really interrogating why we have these terms and how they're used.
So how did all of this come about as a research project? How did this start?
So I had been working with the American Academy of Forensic Sciences Standards Board to create standards for forensic anthropology, accredited standards. And I was working on the standard for ancestry estimation. We started this in 2018. And we sat down as a group, as a working group, to work on the standard. And the first part of that was to define the term ancestry. And we couldn't do it. We couldn't define ancestry without using the word ancestry in the definition. We realized how circular that was, and we weren't really encapsulating what the research was. And as we started to really think about it, we realized that it all kind of fell apart. And we couldn't adequately create the standard using that term. So I just started thinking about, you know, how did we define this term? How are people using it? Is it being defined in the literature? And so I had been talking to all of these different people, all these co-authors about these issues and how they're used within forensic anthropology. So then in late 2018, Samora Horsley and Cassie Skipper and I sat down to talk about this as a research project. And Samora and Cassie started to collect data from the Journal of Forensic Sciences. And we kind of started to formulate this research project to look at terms within the Journal of Forensic Sciences. We specifically had it starting in 1972 when the physical anthropology section started within the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, because we wanted to look at forensic anthropology articles. So then after that, in 2019, there were some papers that explored this topic, including some work by Alba Craig that also looked at some of this terminology work, and she's one of the co-authors. She looked specifically at sort of the last 10 years. And then this kind of all came together also during the scientific meeting of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, when there was a symposium on ancestry estimation and put together several different papers. And some of the terminology that was used in that symposium was offensive to people in the audience. And that also kept us just thinking about, how are we using terms? What do they mean? And how can we look at the past within forensic anthropology in order to sort of shape and imagine a new future? I will just say too, I got the years wrong. It was it was late 2019 that we started working on this project. And it was the meeting at 2020, which was the last meeting we had. It was like the last thing I did before, you know, the world collapsed.
Could you briefly run through the materials and methods used here? I know we touched on it a little bit at the top, that you went through over 300 articles in JFS, but what you were looking for, how you analyzed the data, that kind of thing.
A large part of my impact in working on this project was doing a lot of the data collection. And so, as like I said before, we started looking at the Journal of Forensic Science from 1972 to 2020. And we started at 1972 because that's when the professionalization of forensic anthropology. So there was a lot of articles. We started looking through those articles and seeing if they were using the classifiers. So how they're talking about race, ancestry, and any of those type of categories. And then we're also looking the descriptors, so how they're describing people, what terminology they're using, examples like American Black or white or Indian and things like that. And so we went through all of these articles, and they included letters to the editor, case studies, research, book reviews, everything. And then we finally decided to narrow that down to just articles that focused on anthropology, and we knew that were written by anthropologists. So it got us from that original like 11,000 to like 800 to 300, which what we finally ended up looking at. Part of it was also looking at the census data. We looked at all of the census and what categories they were using in terms that they were using to describe people as well. In addition to NAMIS, missing and unidentified persons system, and seeing what terminology they were using too.
That's wonderful. Can we describe exactly in this article what a classifier means, what are the types, and then what a descriptor is, and what are the differences between those two?
As we started to go through the data, we realized we had to organize it in a way that was understandable and repeatable across articles. So we came up with these terms. In fact, Casey came up with these terms as classifier and descriptor. And the classifier was the term that the authors used to describe what they were observing. So what were they researching? Was it race? Was it ancestry? Was it ethnicity? Was it population? And then the descriptor is the terms that they used to describe their samples within that classifier. So however they chose to describe the groups under that umbrella term of the classifier. So we eventually categorized the classifiers into 5 main groups based on the articles that we had. So those 5 main groups were race, ancestry, ethnic, population, and other. So there were some terms that we only saw in a handful of articles. Those included like nationality, group, or sample. So we kind of just lumped those all together into one other. But the descriptors, those terms that were used under the classifier term, there were, I think it was a total of 160 unique descriptors across all of those classifiers, which was really interesting to see. It was a lot more than I was expecting. And we even standardized those. Some people said American white, some people said white American. We put those together. So we tried to find the patterns where we could to minimize those numbers, but there were still 160 unique terms.
I was going to add that both for the classifiers and descriptors, there's an extremely large amount of terms, but in trying to understand them or thinking about them, that the definitions and the connotations of those words have varied throughout time. To play back on the previous thing that I stated, have varied throughout time, and the definitions and the way that they're understood and the way that they're used in practice, not only differences within forensic anthropology and by the practitioner, but also within different disciplines. So the way these terms are used and understood in sociological contexts and criminal justice contexts, in psychological contexts, et cetera, are not the same way that we're applying them. But I would say as a whole, like forensic anthropology as an entire discipline, not necessarily as an individual, just now, I made air quotes because this is supposed to be just audio. So just now, looking at this is stemming from the fact, in my personal opinion, that much more Black and Brown practitioners are beginning to become involved and are pushing the issue that our science is not in a bubble, that it does have real world affects. I mean, I think that it wasn't previously looked at as well because forensic anthropology has consistently, and that's really making a big shift now, but has consistently operated on quantitative analysis and getting a biological profile as its contribution to science and to the world as a whole. So for general areas of that bio profile and thinking that those methodologies and practices operate within a bubble. You know, even within the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, there are so many other disciplines, and ours as a whole does not interact with the rest of the medical legal field to the extent that I think that would be more appropriate. So taking this bigger picture look of like, hey, our methods are not necessarily being applied in a way that's beneficial for living and past and future individuals is new for those reasons.
Yeah, I love that. And you did a real pro move by already answering a later question about looking into other fields for how they're using these descriptors too. Casey, these figures are amazing. So could you briefly just describe, so we have these classifiers and descriptors. Now, how did you look at these or examined the way that these terms interact or the relationship there might be between them?
So in terms of what I was wanting to look at, the two main things were just kind of trying to capture the dynamics through time of how the terms changed. And then the other big thing was how do classifiers and descriptors interact? And so for the passage of time, it was really a lot of the figures kind of tell the same story in different ways, whether it is the violin plots or the scatter plots. And I don't even know what to call. I've been calling it like the landscape plot that's kind of towards the end, and the dendrogram, I think all really kind of tell that same story in different ways that might be accessible to different people, like in terms of how they want to think about terminology and its changing. And then when you look at networks, that really captures a lot of interactions of what's going on. So the one network where we look at where are these descriptors used with these classifiers, like, tells a very strong story just by looking at it. And then the co-occurrence network, that also kind of tells a story of how things change over time, but more like, where are the bridges? Like, what are the bridge terminology, and when are the transitions happening from one set of terms to another, like from barista ancestry. And then it seems like ethnic as a classifier kind of bridged a gap between those two for little L, and same with population. So that was what I was really trying to get.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. And yeah, I think that we could do a lot of this type of thing in our field, and it could help elucidate some trends that maybe we can't see as easily or be able to identify what it is. Could you please contextualize and define the four classifiers?
The classifiers were taken from the publications. What we saw, the patterns were there. Part of the problem is I can't define them for you because the authors did not define them. So this paper, as the reader will appreciate, is very, very long. I sold it to the journal as being a modular research paper that you could take pieces of it as you needed. So there is a section in the middle where we discuss the history of those terms and how they've changed over time and what they mean. And the point of that section is to highlight, much like Shaughnessy has said, those terms change over time. They have different meaning in different contexts. And that's why it's so important that when you use these terms that you, moving forward, you know, define exactly what you're saying. Doing so will also just kind of make more clear the intent of your research. And anyway, I could talk about that later at sort of where I think the field should go.
I do think that they're kind of things that we just kind of take for granted as being defined, like things that everybody knows. Like, I've been dealing with research where everyone is saying Western all the time, and it's like, what does that mean to different people? And that there's a certain, I think, privilege inherent in it where you just assume everybody thinks like you do and understands the definition of these things. There's no need to. There's like an arrogance.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like it's just this easy, this insidious bias that we just accepted this is the way it is, so we just keep doing it. And we don't challenge that belief ever.
I wanted to add, like, Marin saying that, you know, she's unable to define the terms that we used in this article, or that any of the authors are unable to define them. I just wanted to, like, add some clarity. It's one, because we did use definitions that other people used, or in many cases did not use. And that's not to say that any of the authors don't have a grasp about what these terms are, or could describe them, define them, talk about the different connotations. But also in that essence, and going to the point of they should be defined each and every time someone uses them, it's okay that there's not a singular overarching definition for each one of these terms, right? When we're using language to describe the complexities of human beings, it's okay that more than one definition exists simultaneously. It's okay that I describe this one way for this particular usage, because it's not only dependent on how I see it, but the research that's being done. Also, you know, who is the research being done on, what time it's happening. It's okay that more than one definition for a singular word exists all at the same time in different areas, places, by different people, and for different people.
That is wonderful. And to your point, if we can clearly define what it is, like if you're introducing a new method, like this is what it means to me, this is how it's applied. Now anybody that wants to use it knows exactly its use case and what that means. And that can inform their confidence about whatever it is they're saying, right? I keep thinking of this idea that what we're ultimately doing is making judgments about things. We're running a bunch of tests, we're synthesizing those results in our head, and we're making a judgment call, be it if it's sex, ancestry, stature, that's judgment. And we use these analytical tools to inform our judgment. So if we're going to be certain in our judgments, we need to understand what it is they actually mean before just making it. And I think that little soundbite is so important for everybody to listen to practicing science. Could you talk us through the results for classifiers, in particular in reference to figures 1 and 2? So if people have the article in front of them, they can look at these and see the results.
So starting with figure 1, we chose to use violin plots because it really gives you a sense of how things changed over time. So when you look at race, it starts small. I mean, and partly this is just the number of papers that we're looking at, but it starts small and then kind of peaks in the 90s and then kind of fades away, but it's still being used. And then you look at the term like ethnic, and it just kind of pops up out of nowhere and is used for a while, and then it's kind of still being used. And same with ancestry, which really came on after the Sauer paper. And then population kind of came on a little bit earlier than ancestry. And then it seems like it kind of peaked before ancestry really came on, and then it's kind of faded out.
I'm looking at especially ancestry, where like, so the way I look at these violin plots is, for people listening, if you imagine on the y-axis a histogram, right, showing kind of the density of these estimates through time. So you're seeing both the frequency and its like and its distribution, and it's kind of smoothed out, so you get an idea about what that trend means. How can we contextualize the results using figure two, or what is learned by going through figure two?
All right, so I'll just briefly describe a bipartite network. A good example of a bipartite network is either a predator-prey network. And in this case, we're connecting the classifier that was used to individual publications. And so this was to kind of see how much these classifiers are used together or not. And so when you have single use, so all those, if you look at race at the top there, all those individual nodes are just papers that only use race. And then same for ancestry. So you pretty much, I think there's like one or two that maybe use three terms, three classifiers, and a few more that use two classifiers together. It's kind of just getting at the idea that most of the time, no one's talking about these mixed together. And actually, I went back and looked at some of those nodes that are connected to like race and ancestry, and a lot of them are just papers like ours that are discussing like how they're being used and how often. And then the other element of this was the years, just to kind of, again, have another graphical representation. We didn't need to color code these by year, but it still gives you kind of an idea of the passage of time and when classifiers are being used and when they're being used together. So you see that a lot of the papers that are connected to two classifiers are happen mostly in the 90s and then since 2010. And so that also kind of plays into when that Sauer paper comes out in 1992. And then our more recent discussions about using these terms. Something else I just wanted to quickly say is that, you know, I talked about kind of the long tail of race on the violin plot. But if you look at this, this also provides some additional context in the network, in the sense that if you see when race is being used, you know, in the last decade, it's always like in the context of ancestry, using other terms besides race. So it fills out the story.
Could you talk us through the results for descriptors in reference to figures 4 and 5?
Sure. So this one's also a little bit hard for me to describe. I'll start with the red squares because that's kind of easiest. I overlaid these two plots because I could do them on the same scale and have it still make sense. Try to do that whenever I can, and I didn't have to use a second thing. But the idea of the red dots is each red dot is a year articles published, and the number of terms in this case is the number of unique terms used across all the publications from that. So it doesn't have anything to do with how many times they were used. It was just the absolute number of unique terms used within that, and it's not dependent on the years before it or the years after. So terms will be counted in every year in which they exist, regardless of whether it's. Just to be clear about what I mean by unique, it's just, I mean, I basically use the unique function to get. So, and then the round dots are a little bit more complex, but it's the number of descriptors. Again, this is unique. You know, it's not based on a count of total times of descriptors used, but it's the number of them used in a single article. And then all the articles published in that year are in the same year. So the number of articles that use the same number of descriptors are overlaid, and that leads to the darker ones. So I use transparent dots to do this. And so it's just kind of two different ways of measuring how many descriptors are being used, and it's kind of changing.
All right, well, let's round out the figures. Could you walk us through 6 and 7 before we move on to NamUs stuff?
Sure. If it's okay, I'll start with figure 7, just because it's kind of stuff we've already gone over. This is, in a way, a recapitulation of the violin plot above, but I think it does more to kind of convey how, over time, the uses of these classifiers has changed, and it just... you can really see the trends of when things are being used more, when one is lax.
I mean, those of the 160 descriptors, I think 72 were only used once. And so we just wanted to see what the trends were in using that term. Why were so many terms used in only one article? And so that was, we wanted to see how that like worked with the changes in classifiers.
Let's move on to figure 6, another bipartite network analysis. But what is this one showing us?
I mean, this is also bipartite, but this is what we would call a co-occurrence network. So rather than talking about it like an herbivore plant or predator prey, you would think about it as two different species occurring together at a given location. The gray nodes are classifiers, and the blue nodes are our descriptors. And so you can see we have many more descriptors than classifiers. And all of them are scaled by degree. So degree is the number of edges connected to a given node. So most of the time, in the case of the classifiers, you're looking at the sizes determined by the number of descriptors that are associated with publications where they use that classifier. And so that's why the classifiers tend to be bigger. And then for the descriptors, it's scaled by the number of publications that use that descriptor. So the blue nodes are scaled to the number of publications in which that descriptor was used. So we've got the kind of big triangle in the middle is race, ancestry, and white and black. Those four are used the most as classifiers in descriptors. And I think there's some context here. So some of the bigger descriptors that are not white or black are more associated with ancestry and a little bit with population, but it seems like population is more affiliate kind of single use descriptors. And same with ethnic.
Yeah, it's wonderful because it shows so many different concepts at once, with the blue dots essentially just showing how often that comes up in journals, and then the gray bigger dots, the classifiers, being the how these are described using the descriptors, right? So every time that ancestry is described as a white, that's another thing, so it makes it a little bit bigger. So essentially we're looking at like a generic word cloud that is showing both the connection and the frequency of the interconnectedness of these terms at some level at different scales. So you get an idea of how often are these descriptors used, period, versus how often are these descriptors used to describe this classifier ultimately? Is that
it's kind of like a word cloud network.
Yeah, love that. Okay. So what were the major findings using the NamUs and census data?
So the reason we wanted to bring in the NamUs data and the census data is because the ultimate goal of forensic anthropology and doing ancestry, race, ethnicity estimation is to make an identification or aid in the identification. And so that needs to be done by translating whatever these descriptors are into categories that are housed in official or government documents. So when we estimate ancestry on a skeleton, ultimately, that needs to go to NamUs or a census category to help find that person. So we wanted to see how these terms aligned with each other. And what we found was really they don't at all. So the terms that we're using in forensic anthropology research as descriptors, these 160 descriptors, don't neatly equate to what is available within NamUs data or census data, or how people are forced to self-identify on official records and documentation. So what that means is we have to translate what we're saying about human variation into these social race categories or other categories. And we wanted to dig into that a little bit and kind of explore what that means. How does one do that? You know, I feel like sometimes as Friends Against Apologists, we kind of try to have it both ways, in that we say race is not biological, but then we take these skeletal phenotypic characters and we call them ancestry or race, and then we translate it to a social race category. So it's like a transitive property, right? Like we're trying to remove ourselves a little bit from saying that, but ultimately we are looking at biology and equating it to these social race categories to aid in these identifications. So that was the goal of kind of all of that research there, is to bring in these other terms.
That could be more helpful, one, for what we say we're doing, which is to aid an identification effort. And if we're not being congruent with the terms that the largest missing persons database in the United States has, what worth is our estimation then, or our final judgment? That's hard.
To add on that, like one of the things that I like wanted to mention was that, like, I feel like in our field, we're very like, we view truth in a certain way that we think it's like objective or it's without bias. But like with that assumption, there's the assumption that it's without harm. And so if you look at like the history of just like scientists in this country, you see that, like, you know, they're seeing some type of genetic difference, but the way that they're understanding it and like contextualizing it is where all the problematic stuff, and it's not like coming from just the outside, it's not coming from policies, it's not coming from like individuals, it's coming from scientists themselves that reinforce certain things. And so it gets into this little weird area where it's like, okay, how do we make sure that if we are using a different thing, that it just doesn't become the same thing that we've been doing?
Right. The ancestry versus race replacement, where they just switched to what they called a term and that was it. They did the exact same type of analyses, exact measurements, whatever. It's just, yeah, putting lipstick on a pig. But it's easy, and that's how people stake their careers. I don't think it's right, for sure. And I want to do better. I want to help people think about ways in which it can be used better. So where do we go from here? For everybody, how do we be better? What are things that both an individual can do and organizations can do to help us be better?
I just think that the first thing like you can do as an individual is just like know the history, especially as an undergrad student. You don't know the history. You're just learning whatever the teachers are telling you. And you're like, oh, this is right. And so like I think taking that step to actually understand the history of these groups and like why certain terms are being used and how they're being used is like a really good step, because after that you can start interrogating the norms and practices that we use.
I love that.
I would say on an individual level, the first thing that I would recommend is to read, which sounds so cliche because I think so often people think that they read and that they are readers. But if you're just looking at the articles within your discipline, right, you're not reading and you're not well read. And so that'll go into my next thing, that on the individual level is realizing, incorporating, practicing, living, breathing, eating, which is, I say this nonstop, interdisciplinary work, right? So if you're reading, you shouldn't just be reading what's in the forensic science journals. You should also be reading what's in sociology journals and history journals and biology journals. Being intentional about your interdisciplinary work. So if we're having discussions on race and ancestry, right, read books by authors belonging to marginalized groups. If we're talking about sex and gender, you know, read books by authors that are part of community, right? Read these items outside of your discipline and be intentional about it, because there's so much to be said and there's so much positive impact that can be gained if we were actually working with other disciplines, right? I have often said, and I think still, a lot of the questions that we are circling around and continuing to come with the same answers could be answered if we partnered with, you know, another discipline. I'm beginning to work on my dissertation. I learned that there's an entire family studies department at my university, and I didn't even think that was a whole separate field. I thought family studies were just within other disciplines, right? And so having the opportunity to learn about the existence, right? Every question you have, I guarantee you somebody studies a very, very specific area of the question that you've asked, right? But we have got to branch out, read better with more intent, right? And incorporate those other thoughts, ideas, and those other people into our work. So that would be my main takeaway on an individual level is just stop thinking our anthropology journals have the answer. And please, please go pick up like a book from anywhere else, just any book. And, you know, look at the history department, go and talk to somebody in the sociology department, please just go say hello. They have so much to give and we have so much to give to them as well. So that's what I would say. Please do that.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love that. It's so necessary in our field to just have open dialogues. One, because you get a diversity in opinions, which makes you better because it gives you another alternative explanation. And maybe you didn't even realize it was available to you until someone's like, oh, did you think about it this way? Because they have a different, an entire different lens through which information is filtered and what you can glean from it, right? So we get so pigeonholed into viewing things just this way that we lose sight of how much there is there all the time.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, this paper, I wish Debbie could have been here today. Debbie Boehm, she is a cultural anthropologist who's on this paper. I think she would have some really interesting insight to add. And then even, sorry, this is just me rambling, but like talking to Casey about a lot of this stuff too is interesting because like, I don't know, you think that as anthropologists, we'd be a lot further with a lot of these discussions than we actually are. So what do I think you could do as an individual? I have a lot of thoughts that I'll try to say, not super long-winded, because what Samora and Shaughnessy said is amazing and very thoughtful and insightful and gives me hope for the future of the discipline. Mine are not as beautiful as that. Mine are more nuts and bolts. So I think that we need to, like I said earlier, we need to remove our gaze on race and really start to engage in research that's hypothesis driven and not typologically driven. And so that means, you know, reevaluating our questions and what is of value to the forensic anthropology as a discipline. What do we want our contribution to be? Because ultimately, forensic anthropology is working with communities, and we need community buy-in in order to make identifications and resolve these medical legal death investigations. And if the community doesn't trust us or our methods, then we can't do our work. So we need to see how our research is contributing to community mistrust and how we can reframe those questions to really explore what's at the heart of human variation, which I think is what we should be doing. And we need to remove ourselves from, you know, constantly looking for social race categories to explain everything when they don't. So hypothesis-driven research that explicitly defines terminology and what, you know, expectations are and what the research is contributing. I think too, we need to really think about how we then present that research and how we present it in public spaces and how we teach it. I think, Mike, you talked to Dr. Kenny Hertz. You talked to Dr. Adams about some of their research on the misappropriation of biological anthropology by race scientists. And so doing some of that work with Donovan really opened my eyes to how much harm some of this work is doing and how it is contributing to this idea of race as being biological and contributing to white nationalist agendas. So I think we really need to think about that and think about that when we teach some of these methods in undergraduate courses. And in fact, I think we shouldn't at all. You know, we can talk about human variation, but I don't think we should talk, you know, we need to reevaluate how we present that human variation. And if we link it to specific methodologies that give you a specific answer, I think we need to really stop that in undergraduate teaching because the potential harm outweighs any potential good that could do, right? So, and then also in public lectures. So how we present the work that we do and how we do it and what and why we do it and really thinking how we engage with those communities. And then finally, I think Shaughnessy brought this up too, that forensic anthropology is a very white discipline and it's been a lot of work by white scholars for other white scholars. And that has not gotten us very far. So we really need to think about how we can diversify the discipline and how we can move forward with more diverse thought and lived experiences, and how that can all contribute to the research that we're doing and make it a better discipline overall.
And a lot of that as well, like with teaching, just to add to that, is in almost every classroom, whether it be undergraduate or graduate programs, and that is changing now, honestly, within the past few years, but those syllabi are just very, very white focused, very Eurocentric, very non-diversified. And I mean that to say both in the authors of those works, the individuals within the works that they're talked about, and also within like the discipline and the studies, right? The syllabus are, it makes that cyclical event happen, right? And so that teaching is because there's no diversity in the teaching, right? And so a major thing as well, right? When my inspirational, please read something, right? To do a lot of what Marin said as far as like very impactful, like you can make this change, is like to even get some of those things going is like you've got to read something else. You've got to go outside of like your little think bubble and see something else, get another perspective. You can't make a change if you just sit in your own isolated thoughts, right? You have to have something that's influencing and pushing it. And I'm not necessarily making that for the connotation of negative or positive. I'm just saying, right, like there needs to be more individual active work with intent to go outside of what we have come across the past 50 years within our discipline.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think even more broadly or generic, if we're scientists, we should always be working to falsify our beliefs and not reinforcing them by looking at the echo chamber of the same articles over and over again, you know? And like, yeah. So if we're not constantly reevaluating and challenging our beliefs, we can't grow or get better. So we have to. And that means taking a critical look like this at us, which I'd imagine is probably hard for some people in the field to face this, right? And imagining they might be thinking like, this might be an attack on me or work that I've done personally. And that's not the point. The point is you did work, you contributed to the field. However, we all know we can be better and no one's doing anything about it. So let's start. And that's hard because it's challenging to a person, right? And people don't like to feel challenged. Maybe I'm just projecting myself here, but I like to think I'm open to new ideas and a discourse on those ideas. And I want to be better. I don't want to be the person that thinks the same way all the time. That's boring. And I don't learn anything new along the way. So what's the point of being a human then, let alone a scientist?
If there is anyone that would feel that way, I would say, just take a moment and realize that it's not about you. It's not about you. It's not about us. It's not about any individual. It's so much bigger than that. And when someone says something's not about you, you know, it's not in any way a personal thing. It's just a generalized, this ain't about you. It's not about you.
Yeah, I think it comes down to white folks aren't used to having their agency taken from them in this way. And that feeling, it caused like such panic. But I think that's necessary because that's what marginalized communities feel all the time, you know? So maybe this one time, yeah, you're being called out because you haven't been self-reflective. You should feel a little bit of shame for not doing it, but you don't have to be a shameful person. It can serve its purpose. Yeah, maybe now I should think differently about how I'm interacting with the field, my research, my teaching. Right? It's an opportunity to change, to be a positive, kind of net positive change in the field. And it doesn't take a huge step, right? It just admitting you don't know as much as you think you know, or admitting I should update my beliefs because I'm a scientist, or I say I am, and that's what scientists do. They update their beliefs.
Being comfortable in discomfort is necessary for progress.
Exactly. You got to embrace that suck. Just let it happen, because the more you push against it, the suckier it is.
I guess the stage in my life is I just started a master's program. So I'm in the process of coming up with ideas and, you know, what type of research do I want to be doing and how. And so I think that having this article and just having discussions that we're having in the field is a really good impact.
So my approach to anthropology from the very start has been asking a lot of these questions. And quite honestly, you know, like when Marin discusses like inclusion of diversified scientists, right? A lot of the work that I've done with Marin has provided opportunity to give those ideas and those voices to be more confident in expressing those, because it's also an instance or the case where there's a lack of retention for scientists of color to stay within any discipline because you're pushed out, right? And so I like to feel in my heart that I'm a very persistent person and that, you know, you're not going to get rid of me, but it's hard, right? It's exhausting. And so like this article as a whole, there's multiple authors of color, right? And to be able to provide those ideas or have a platform that we didn't necessarily have to like kill ourselves over is extraordinarily important. Even like if you're thinking about individual actions, is thinking about the retention of diversity, whether it be of other disciplines, right? How long are you going to continue to incorporate other ideas? How long are you going to continue to incorporate marginalized groups, right? Thinking about retention is an important factor as well.
Thank you so much to Marin, Samora, Shaughnessy, and Casey for such an incredible chat. And thank you for listening. We will be back soon with the authors of On Weird Anthropologists and Their White Skeletons. Until then, be good.